morning and welcome to the March term of court here at the University of South Dakota School of Law. A couple of preliminary matters. While we did not print the synopsis of this in the booklet form, because most people get them off the internet ahead of the oral arguments, for those of you that don't have access to the internet, we do have a few printed copies available in the lobby, along with the pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The first case for oral argument this morning is the Rapid City Journal and Associated Press, who are the applicants, versus the Honorable John J. Delaney, the circuit judge from the 7th Judicial Circuit. For the applicants, we have Mr. John Arneson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the respondent, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hallam, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Mr. Arneson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, and I'm sure it does please you that I'm on time this time. My name is John Arneson. As you said, I'm representing the Rapid City Journal, South Dakota Newspaper Association, and the Associated Press, and I would also like to note for the record that Mr. Raj Schlager of Rapid City was co-counsel for the Rapid City Journal in this case. As the court is aware, this case is an original mandamus proceeding that is challenging two exclusionary orders that were entered by the Honorable John Delaney of the Seventh Circuit in connection with a court trial to determine the fair value of a family business, the family business being Bear Country USA. One order was a comprehensive gag order on the participants. It extended to the parties, the attorneys, and those in privity with them. And the second order was a court closure order that essentially closed a substantial part of the trial, or what I would call a fair value hearing, to the public and the media. This court, upon our petition, or application, accepted jurisdiction. It then issued an alternative writ of mandamus on June 10th of 2010. By the way, the whole trial of this case happened in late April of 2010. So on June 10th, this court issued the alternative writ of mandamus, which required Judge Delaney to show cause why the writ should not become permanent. Now, the media believe that Judge Delaney's responsive brief has not established a sound legal basis why his exclusionary orders should, in the context of the Bear Country fair value case, should not be rescinded. Now, the issues...
standing as the underlying basis would be that the financial records were considered to be a trade secret, correct?
That apparently is the case. The motion originally made to close fair value hearing was made by corporate counsel. Now, all the parties, all the family members, I think there were eight of them, seven or eight, were all represented by counsel. There was a separate corporate counsel who represented the corporation and was not really part of the fair value hearing, but he made the motion, asked that the court proceeding on the fair value, which, as you know, comes in the corporate law, be closed. And his only explanation or rationale was that this was a trade secret case.
Because we have corporate records all the time, divorces, probates, and that's what makes this case apparently unique, is that it's considered to be a trade secret?
Apparently they thought that, he thought that everything in the fair value hearing was going to be considered a trade secret, and he used the definition of trade secret right from the Trade Secrets Act, which I don't disagree with. I mean, I think that's a valid, legitimate definition of a trade secret, but trade secrets typically are those that will put you, if they are disclosed, that secrecy is a very important aspect of them, and if they are disclosed, that will put you at a competitive disadvantage, and that the trade secret probably keeps your competitive advantage. There's something special about a trade secret. It's not just every piece of corporate information or financial information in a business. And that is what happened here.
Well, then, do you agree that trade secrets should not be open to access?
I definitely think there are reasons when courtrooms can be closed and records can be sealed, and I do not dispute that trade secrets are one of those. And I think in my brief, I use the example, and again, I'm not trying to be condescending here. This is a very big business. I appreciate that the Bear Country is very successful and very prominent. I was taken to task by the Attorney General's office for suggesting that this is not a multinational or international business, and I was being condescending in my brief. I am not. I'm simply using the example of the Coke formula. That's a trade secret. Obviously, if you start litigating, Coca-Cola might be in a dispute with Pepsi. Well, Coke's not going to have to reveal its formula in a case with Pepsi. This isn't that kind of case. This is an intramural case in which family members are trying to establish the value of their family business so one side can buy out the other. They all have a vested interest in keeping their trade secrets a secret. They don't need to be told by the judge or anybody else that this doesn't have to be divulged in a courtroom or by them. And so the gag order essentially was unnecessary.
Then let's back down one step. What about proprietary matters?
Well, I don't even know what the word proprietary matters really includes.
Well, but it's used throughout your briefs, and it's used in the judge's decision. In fact, there's three categories of materials that we have to look at, and I'd like your view as to how we should treat each three, that being personal financial matters, proprietary information, and we've already just discussed trade secrets.
Proprietary information, to the best of my knowledge, is it may not amount to a trade secret, but the proprietary indicates ownership, which, of course, you own all your records. I don't really know what the distinction is.
Well,
I think there
can it be protected?
Pardon?
Should it be? I think
if there's a possibility that you will be put at a competitive disadvantage or that the release or divulgence of that information will be irreparably damaging to your business, yes. But, again, that begs the question, is it even relevant to the fair value hearing in the first place? It seems to me, and I'm not a corporate attorney by trade, so I don't pretend to be expert in this matter, but it seems to me if you're going to value a corporation and you have two sides that are essentially at one point in league, in concert, they want to know what their business is worth, you have a bunch of assets and you have experts come in and say this is worth so much. I don't think you have to divulge the Coke formula. I don't think you have to divulge the specifics that might be considered proprietary information or how much each member of the family is worth to figure out what the value of the land is worth, the beers are worth, and the going business.
Mr. Arneson, what test are you asking us to apply, or are you saying that just in this case there was an abuse of discretion, or are you proposing some kind of a test that we should be looking at
to
look at these cases?
I'm not going to be so presumptuous as to tell you that I should create law for eternity, but I do think that we need to get rid of this law in this case, because what happened here was we have, on the first issue, the gag order, we have a comprehensive gag on the participants in this case that the judge even admitted in the oral imposition of the gag order during the closure hearing. He said this gag is going to apply to the attorneys, the parties, those in privity with them, and will apply to all matters that happen in the courtroom, whether it's privileged or unprivileged. I mean, there's no legal rationale for that.
Well, is it the same test for the gag order and the closing the courtroom, or are they two different issues?
They are two different issues, but I think the tests are very similar. First, you have to have a compelling interest, national security being one, trade secret maybe being one, that needs protection, and that the media's or the public's access, the news gathering process may impair. There has to be a reasonable likelihood that a compelling interest is at stake and will be prejudiced by the media's presence. And obviously, if a trade secret is being divulged and the media covers it, you have a problem. Typically, this applies in the criminal context when we have the competing interest of the criminal defendant who's worried about getting a fair trial, and we're worried about an impaneled jury and prejudicing them. That's normally where these gags and court closures come into play. We don't have that here. We have a court trial. We had a court trial. The fair value was simply a court trial. Judge Delaney had no problem, or should have had no problem, with what these parties said outside of court, because I think, at least I take as gospel, that you, when you were serving as judges, were impartial and weren't going to be affected by what was going on outside your courtroom. I think we worry about juries. I don't think we have to worry about judges. Okay, and in essence, Judge Delaney at one point suggested that part of the reason for the need for the gag and the need for the closure was he didn't want people talking. Well, it was in the brief, I should say. It was in his brief that it would affect or could affect, substantially affect his decision-making.
I got to follow up on Justice Severson's question about the test we're to apply here, because if we're to adopt your theory, if we're to rule for you, we first have to lay down a rule or a test and say that Judge Delaney violated this rule or test. So what rule or test would you have us apply? And forget about the gag order for a minute.
Okay.
Just go to the documents and the trial. What rule did he violate, and how should that test be applied in this case?
First, I think you have to, I think it's a four-part test. One, there has to be a compelling interest that overcomes the presumption of the First Amendment right of access. I believe we start with a presumption of a right of access stemming from the First Amendment. Media and public have a right to sit in on courtroom situations. This is a branch of government. To overcome that presumption, I think you have to have a compelling interest and that there has to be a reasonable likelihood that the access will prejudice that substantial or compelling interest. Again, typically in a criminal context. Third, if you reach that point and you have made the decision that there's a reasonable likelihood that a compelling interest will be imperiled, then you have to craft an order that takes into consideration, are there reasonable alternatives that can produce the same result without keeping the media and public out of the courtroom? And if that is not the case, then the order that closes the courtroom has to be crafted in a way that minimizes the exclusion. So those are the four parts, but basically the important ones that you want me to address, there has to be a compelling, overriding interest that exceeds, surpasses what I consider to be a presumed right of access of the media and public to the court system.
And procedurally, how are we going to use that in the course, in the middle of a trial? Did this erupted in the middle of this trial?
No, it erupted before.
Well, but the actual, you intervened after the order. You got involved after the order had been entered.
Yes, the Rapid City Journal had been involved prior to that. I didn't get involved until after.
So procedurally, how's this going to work?
Well, procedurally, I guess what I would like to do is create a standard. So theoretically, yeah, we can't.
Well, does the judge stop the trial and litigate all these issues and then start the trial over when they're done litigating?
He actually had an opportunity to do this before the trial. He had a closure hearing, and I think he made the wrong decisions. I'm just saying he erred in making those decisions. He did not need to impose, he should not have imposed the gag order, certainly not the comprehensive gag order that he did. And secondly, I think that when you look at the court closure, 80% of the trial being closed, and if we look, again, I'm not privy to what happened. I don't have that 80% of the transcript, as you know. I got a redacted transcript, so I cannot give you specifics on what was entertained in that fair value trial that should not have been, but I can tell you from the stuff that I put in my brief that Judge Delaney actually admitted several times that he was exceeding what he thought was that he was trampling upon the media and public's right of access.
Going back to your Coke-Pepsi analysis, I'm assuming Pepsi would be very interested in what Coke's formula is.
Yes.
But here, apparently, all the parties agreed to close. Is that right?
Nobody objected.
So does that make a difference?
No. They don't get to have a private trial. Our government is not established to have private court trials. There are exceptions when you can close certain things, but I don't think that, and this is where Judge Delaney also was getting, and I'm not saying you're confused, but Judge Delaney was confused because what his standard was, he wanted to keep the public out if they did not generally have a right to know the information that was being conveyed in the courtroom. In other words, he took what the public generally would have a right to know in the private sector and put it into the public sector. So basically, to give you an example, let's assume that your wife hides the remote control during the NCAA basketball tournament. I don't have a right to know that. That's personal information. However, if you sue her for intentional infliction of emotional distress in the United States court system, and that becomes material evidence, I do then have a right to know that. You don't have a right. I don't have a right. None of us has a right to say we want private trials in the state of South Dakota or in the United States.
So what you're saying is that they want that kind of a private proceeding, they should look to arbitration.
And I understand, I sympathize with families that have these kinds of disputes, but I'm saying, I'm sorry, it's too bad. You don't lose all your right of privacy, but let's frankly understand that you can't expect the public taxpayer to pay for a private trial for you. We also have accountability issues here, and I think that's the key to the First Amendment. We need the accountability of all branches of government, and if you don't have public access to it, you don't have accountability. So
let me ask you this about the, you know, we have a constitutional provision about open courts. How does that play into your...
Well, that's a little different. I mean, I'd love to say, Your Honor, that there we go, I can sit down. But it really, that's saying we all have a right to the remedy of the court. And that's why I think Judge Delaney's brief was wrong when he was suggesting we shouldn't be here. Procedurally, they raised a couple of things. I think we can avail ourselves as a media and public through mandamus to exercise our right to see if our First Amendment issue should be resolved. And I think that is what the open court provision provides. However, I will say in following up that I think clearly our United States Supreme Court has said criminal courts are open, every stage of them. That's a presumption, and there will not be one case out there that I have found that will say that presumption probably doesn't apply to the civil court system. Now, the United States Supreme Court has not had that case yet where they've said that, but most every circuit has. Now, the Fifth Circuit, Federal Circuit, which Judge Delaney latched onto in defense, actually they've reversed themselves too. And I cited a case in my reply brief, the Holy Land, something or other, and it basically is saying, wait a minute, let's back up. There is a presumption of public and media access to all court proceedings, criminal or civil. And that's what happened here. We lost that. Judge Delaney, in the context of the hearings and the trial, and I pointed out those spots in my brief and application, he actually said, I do not buy a presumption of access under the First Amendment. And I don't criticize him because, it was just his perception. But he looked at the general public and read it differently from being a right of access of the general public. And he looked at it in terms of what does the public generally have a right to know? And again, what I generally have a right to know about you, and you, and Jeff...
2 minutes, counsel.
Privately, is completely different from what I have a right to know once we start litigating with one another in a public courtroom.
What about the example of if I'm sued for divorce, I'm sued, and involuntarily, I don't want a divorce, and I'm sued. What about my personal financial statement? Does the media have access to that?
That's where I think a judge has reason. Now, I don't know where the line is drawn, but I do think there's need for some protection when there's a difference between voluntary and involuntary, in my estimation. I think it's a factor. I don't know how you know, I can't say 70%, 30%, 40%. I don't know how much of a factor, but I do think it does make a difference in a judge's perception of how the whole thing plays out and what needs protection in what particular instance. However, I guess, you know, I can't really draw a firm line. I don't know that I'm equipped to do that. I'm not sure that any of us is, and I think that's why the law evolves gradually. But if you're involuntarily being sued for divorce, and one of the issues is support, I do think that you're probably going to end up divulging what your income is. I don't know if they're going to see your tax returns, but, you know, I think certain of that information is going to be made public by virtue of the fact that you're in the American court system. It's not all good. I'm not saying that all of it is a positive from our personal sense of privacy, but, you know, we're also not, you know, we're not divulging your Social Security number, but I guess there are going to be financial pieces of information that are going to be relevant to the decision-making, and in that context, presumably would be open unless there's some compelling showing that it shouldn't be.
Your time has expired, Mr. Ernst.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Hallam, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices, I'm representing Judge Delaney here today. The Attorney General's office periodically represents circuit court judges in proceedings like this, so this is nothing unusual. I like to rely on my briefs as it relates to the standard review for mandamus and also the procedural arguments that we raised about the media, through their own neglect, having an available remedy and not proceeding forward with it, and also mootness. Before I go to the merits on it, I would like to address one standing issue, and that relates to the gag order. The standard of review that this court adopted in Miller is you have to show direct injury. The media has not shown direct injury. The case law that relates to direct injury and these type of cases is, but for the order, would a trial participant had discussed matters with the press. And the minimum standard that any court has set is there a reasonable likelihood of that? There's nothing in the record to support this. Mr. Anderson's own statement was it was surplusage. It wasn't needed. Well, if that's true, they can't show any injury on it. So that is a legitimate standard. It's something that the media needs to prove. They haven't done it in this case. Now,
doesn't the trial court's order kind of forestall that showing? Because here you have an order saying that no one can talk about the case, so the press goes to one of the participants and says, will you tell us about it? And they say, I can't talk about it.
You don't even have that in the record, Justice Cohen Camp. You have nothing in the record. In Sioux Falls Argus Leader versus Miller, we had trial participants that were more and willing to discuss things with the press. In most circumstances, you have that. But in this case, there's no showing of that. So that is the burden that the press has to show. It is a jurisdictional issue. And the fact that Judge Delaney found a general standing of the Rapid City Journal to deal with the disclosure orders, we feel still wasn't sufficient to show that they had injury in fact. What I'd like to do now, though, is to move what I think is the most important issue before the court, and that's the standard of review and how should the court look at these type of orders. And I think it's important to look at this in context. First of all, this is a civil proceeding, not criminal. The United States Supreme Court has clearly held that public access is within the First Amendment guarantees in a criminal hearing, criminal trial, and related proceedings that have been presumptionally open in the past. There is not a United States Supreme Court ruling as relates to civil proceedings. In fact, the court specifically said in its decisions that it was not addressing a civil proceeding, and that's what we have here today. And we're having the epitome of a civil proceeding, which is evaluation of a private business enterprise.
But isn't there really a presumption? Because if you look at our code, it tells you when hearings are going to be closed. Juvenile hearings are going to be closed. The court has authority... In other civil only where the statute says so, doesn't it?
Justice Gilbertson, what I'm talking about is a guaranteed First Amendment right. Judge,
well, yeah,
there's a difference because that is the standard of review on it. If you give a First Amendment access right, you have a different standard of review than you do with the common law presumption of openness, and then you have two common law presumption of openness. You have the strong presumption certain courts have given, and you have an ordinary presumption, which the Eighth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit have done with proceedings and records. Now, that's important because that's how you're going to review a judge's decision. So if you determine to volunteer and say we're going to apply First Amendment review, that is a different standard of review than what the Supreme Court applied under the common law presumption in Nixon versus Warner Communications. Because in that case, the court found that you review an order under abuse of discretion, and the judge, when it determines whether to close or to seal a record, that that decision is made upon the ordinary exercise of the judge's discretion, balancing the competing interests of the parties based upon the facts and circumstances before the court. Now, that is a different standard review than the one that Mr. Arneson has been advocating, because what Mr. Arneson is advocating is a First Amendment standard of review. So one of the things that both Justice Sinner and Justice Severson were asking is, what is the standard of review? And what I would urge you is, until the United States Supreme Court finds a First Amendment guarantee implicit in civil proceedings as they did in criminal, that the court does not need to go there. The Eighth Circuit has never found a First Amendment right because it's never felt that it had a reason to go there. What the Eighth Circuit has done is recognize, as this court did in discipline of Johnson, that there's a presumption of openness, but the court review is not heightened scrutiny. It is standard discretion. Should this be open? Should this be closed? What are balancing the interests between the parties and then making a decision? Now, there's no need to find...
Isn't this court, though, free to... I mean, the courts of South Dakota, with the South Dakota Constitution, aren't we... don't we have an ability to determine what that standard is, this court itself?
Yes, you do, Justice Meyer-Henry.
So, if I mean, it's... We have the authority to say that it's heightened scrutiny for the courts of South Dakota, and that it would apply to civil cases as well.
You're right, Justice Meyer-Henry. But I don't see any need to apply a First Amendment standard review to civil proceedings, because the fundamental purpose of the First Amendment guarantee was to foster free discussion of governmental activities. Now, you have that in a criminal proceeding. There is governmental action and interests involved, and the public has the right to have the access to see what is done in a criminal proceeding on it. But when you look in the civil context, the other interests that Mr. Arneson raised, that dealing with fairness or integrity of the system, that's more, that system, those type of interests can be encompassed in a common law presumption of openness and in the balancing standards. So what I'm not here asserting that there is not a presumption of openness, but what is the court standard of review in looking at the trial judge's order? And that's very important, and that's essential guidance that the trial judges need in civil proceedings, because civil proceedings, we have all different types.
Well, let me ask you this, then. If there is a presumption, following your line, in this case, he closes it because of financial records, and that basically more of the gossip factor that he didn't, you know, that there were a lot of people very interested in these finances, and so he closes it. Wouldn't that even be an abuse of discretion under your standard?
How I reviewed his orders and your findings, Your Honor, is this. He closed the proceedings and he sealed the records as it relates to trade secrets, proprietary information, and internal finance.
There really weren't any trade secrets here, were there? It's all financial.
The other two that he had was proprietary information, and I view proprietary information as, how does the business work? What is the internal workings of the business? You know, how... what is our marketing plan, what is our expansion activities. Those are usually confidential type of matters, and then also internal financial records that are normally confidential. In fact, this court has determined in 1515A that these type of financial information is sealed, that they're not available to the public. So the court's own order and the standard of review that the court has in 1515A is standard abuse of discretion. There's nothing that I could read in 1515A in the statutes that the court has for allowing access to court records that would apply the First Amendment or some heightened presumption on it. So, and Judge Delaney was relying in part upon your rules regarding that other information on it. What he was looking at is that Bear Country was an unwilling party in this participation. You have a dispute among the shareholders, but Bear Country USA is a separate person on it, and it's divulging its business. And it's an unwilling participant in this proceeding on it. Now, one group or the other, the shareholders would get it, but, you know, how far can a judge do to protect an ongoing business enterprise when the business itself is not the subject of the litigation? It's all tangential.
The judge makes a comment during, I don't know if it got into the findings, but he says, I frankly don't think this information is newsworthy. How does newsworthiness factor into a decision like this?
I think it goes with the balancing of the competing interests between the public and the parties on it. It is what is the interest in this case for public access to look at the internal business records and functionings of Bear Country USA.
The judge has the province to decide newsworthiness, and that sounds to me like censorship.
If you're determining the competing interests on it, what is the reason for access? Now, if this was a publicly held corporation, the public would have a higher degree of access. If this was a consumer protection case that our office was bringing to sue a business for wrongdoing, the public would have a higher degree of access. And that would determine what records would be available or not. So, in effect, is that when the judge uses newsworthy, I have what is the nature of the interests of the public on it. And I think, you know, the courts have said if the only interest is curiosity, that's a low level of public interest, and that would afford, and when you're balancing the private interest versus the public, give you the ability to enter an order to allow closure, to allow sealing of records when you're dealing with internal financial information. So I think it is relevant, Justice Konenkamp, on it. Justice Delaney wouldn't articulate it the way I did, but in his written order, he talked about curiosity and said, is that the public interest that's here today? You know, so what you have is Bear Country USA, we're not dealing with violating some regulations. We're not dealing with Bear Country's relationship with the public at large. It would be similar to a divorce proceeding when you're dealing with property distribution and you're dealing with an ownership of a business on it, you're trying to determine what the property's worth. In order to do that, you have to look at the internal records. You have to look at, what is this business worth?
Along that line, though, we don't normally close those. I don't remember ever closing a divorce case because there was financial information.
Did somebody make the request, Your Honor?
Well, I don't know that. You mean anytime somebody makes a request, then you're supposed to close it?
I think then, I'm just asking, if somebody made the request, then you'd have to do the balancing interests. If nobody asks on it, then the presumption of openness would be there.
So really, then if we would rule this way, it pretty much would close a lot of cases that perhaps have not been closed before.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because you would have to apply the Warner Communications, Nixon versus Warner Communications. You start out with the presumption of openness. And then what you have to say is the facts and circumstances of this case warrant closure or warrant the sealing of the documents. And that is a fact-intensive, fact-specific determination on it. And when you do that, you look at what are the competing interests.
Enough, then along that line, was there enough factual determination made in this case for us to review it, to know whether or not there was abuse of discretion?
Judge Delaney did findings and conclusions in his written findings and conclusions, so you have those. Also, you did not have the type of document-by-document discussion because then you have the problem, is that open or is that closed? What's available or not? Do I make these determinations beforehand? Do I have a trial within a trial? Now, what you have in this case is not a full-blown trial. You're only having evaluation of a business. So we have to start out with that. This is not a full divorce proceeding, or this isn't even the full litigation over the management and control of Bear Country. This is just what is a business worth, a very narrow, narrow proceeding. And what you're dealing there with is determining what a business is worth are the revenues and those type of factors on it. And when you deal with experts, in order to cross-examine an expert, you have to ask what they're relying upon. So I think this case is unique from the narrowness of the proceeding and the type of issues that are raised.
We have to look at cases in the future, not just this one. Frankly, it concerns me a lot because we deal with valuations of probates and divorces, guardianships. If we rule in your favor, are we now going to start a rush to the courthouse to close these types of business records, no matter whether it's a mom-and-pop operation or a large multinational corporation?
I think what you need to have, Your Honor, again, is that this court has the opportunity to set standards. What are the circumstances upon which a judge can do? But if you adopt the First Amendment, then you're talking about either an overriding or compelling interest. And to be real honest, in a civil context, I don't know what reaches that. So then you're having everything open, and you're allowing injury to private businesses. Now, you are forcing them to go to arbitration, which to me starts infringing upon the open court rights. You have the ability to go address things in open court. That's what the constitutional amendment's for. If you're going to say everything's public on it, you're going to be forcing businesses to go to private arbitration, which is inconsistent with the open courts. So it's a balancing. That's what we're saying here today, Your Honors, is it's a balancing test of competing interests. Different case, different result on it. And when you're dealing with evaluation of a business that's tangential to the litigation involved, I think more things can be sealed. I think that's within a judge's discretion when you're dealing with internal business records. Now, they're in a different trial, if this was a tort action or if this was a theft issue, certain records would become relevant. Certain things would have to be public access. And then the public's interest to know when there's wrongdoing would be higher than idle curiosity on what a business is worth. So, again, it would be the balancing standard. I view this as the extreme example where private interests should prevail over public access.
You mentioned open courts. Mr. Arneson was asked about whether the state constitutional provision has any application here. I think I heard him to basically suggest no. What's your view? Is that provision of our state constitution intended to apply to disclosure of records?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the open courts is just what Mr. Arneson said. That allows me the entitlement and right to utilize the courts and that they're open for me for redress. And that's how the courts have already always applied those. When you're dealing with access on it, the courts have not looked at the open courts provisions on it. What they've looked at is the common law presumption and then what standard of common law presumption, which varies, and then whether or not there's a First Amendment guarantee. The courts do not look at the open courts. But I do look at the open courts as relevant from the standpoint of is it if the courts are not available to protect legitimate privacy rights, is it you're then forcing them to go into arbitration, which is not a solution to the public. It's not a solution to anybody. And that's one of the things that Judge Delaney was looking at on it. So I think, we think it's very important for this court to establish standards and guidance for the trial court. I think that's something that Judge Delaney mentioned, throughout the process on it. And that's why we're here today, emphasizing the standard of review, what the court should do and why.
Let me ask you about the gag order. Judge Delaney issued the gag order, according to the record, under his inherent authority to conduct a fair trial, an orderly trial. This was a court trial, not a jury trial. How could this gag order have possibly been necessary for him to conduct a trial. I mean, he was conducting the trial, not a jury was not involved here.
Your Honor, how I view what Judge Delaney did is if you look at the written order itself, is that the initial order was for proprietary and financial information. And what the judge was concerned about is that if there was confidential information that was made public, to the extent that the value of the business relied upon the confidentiality of that information, it's gone. Therefore, that would diminish the value of the business. If I had a new marketing plan that I was going to go forward and expand Bear Country, and I was going to have something unique and competitive, and now all of a sudden that's made known to the public, that value of that prospective business expansion is gone. So it would affect his determination because there is no longer any value to my marketing plan that's unique and separate that I was keeping confidential. That was the reason for the order on it. That was the basis for his decision on it and the written order limitation on it, that he was concerned that during the heat of battle, one of the Caseys would say, I'm going to torpedo the value of the business by making something public. Now, he could have held that person in contempt, but that would not have changed the fact that he would have had to give value to the business based upon the public's knowledge of this otherwise confidential information. So I believe that the order itself was legitimate, is that it was to protect the value of Bear Country. It was to protect the value of the interests of the shareholders on it. So that's why we believe and we've asserted that was reasonable. And that was how we view the basis of the judge's decisions. Thank you very much. I see my time's gone.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Mr. Gallant. Mr. Arneson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I think I'd like to just quickly touch upon a few things that Mr. Hallam brought up that deserve quick rebuttal. First, I think that he used the term neglect in how we proceeded here. The media, at least my clients, and I guess I represent everybody, so that's everybody, did everything with complete diligence. We started this proceeding. We asked the judge for a redacted transcript with the benefit of hindsight. We started an appeal while we were waiting for the Supreme Court to grant us the permission to proceed with a mandamus. And once that mandamus alternative writ was issued, we voluntarily dismissed the appeal. We did everything conceivable procedurally to do what was right and proper. And if we were to be kicked out on a procedural ground at this point, then the media and the public would have no rights in the future ever, because they would never have it. They wouldn't be able to avail themselves of anything. In the most situations, they're not even parties. So they, you know, and I did ask to intervene, by the way, and was never given an order that allowed me to intervene, so I probably couldn't have appealed anyway beyond the Rapid City Journal. The Miller case, I will say that the gag order in the Miller case was completely different from this. This gag order tried to keep the parties, who, by the way, if they weren't going to talk, there was no need for the gag in the first place, and the judge admitted that they probably weren't inclined to talk if they were all interested in not talking. They were only going to do themselves harm. Why would they do that? I don't think he thought it through. I think he was interested as the testimony and his response, not testimony, but his response to the argument in the closure hearing that preceded the fair value. It was completely dedicated to his interest in privacy. He didn't even talk for more than a small percentage of the time about the trade secret issue, because I don't think anybody thought there really was a trade secret issue. He was concerned about these people airing their dirty laundry in public. And frankly, they don't need to be protected from themselves. If they want to talk about how much they own or whatever, he doesn't need to protect them. With respect to Miller 2, the Miller court, this court said specifically in Miller, that gag order in Miller that was upheld was counterbalanced by the fact that the media was allowed access to the proceedings. And the Miller court made special reference to that point, saying we were protected and the news gathering right was protected. Here, The media and public were left out of 80% of a fair value hearing, and I do contest whether that fair value hearing was simply tangential. I think that was the be-all and end-all of this case. What is the value of the corporation, and who's going to buy whom out? That was the case. And to suggest that 80% of it was somehow in need of protection for trade secrets or proprietary information or whatever, I think is patently ridiculous. Every aspect of this case in which Judge Delaney is on the record indicates his interest in privacy. And then, to complicate things, in his findings and conclusions, he actually goes to the point of saying, that is not to say that the dirty laundry which caused the dispute or plays a role in its resolution and most other matters should be protected. Yet, we look at the transcript, or at least I look at the transcript I was given, 20% of it, and clearly he was protecting that dirty laundry, if in fact that was part of the process. I don't know what that 80% of the trial was all about, but I do know that he even admitted that a lot of it dealt with stuff that was either irrelevant, did not need protection. He at one point even said, I know that I'm not quoting directly here, but he's trampling upon the media's right.
All right. If I understand Mr. Hanlon correctly, he was not arguing that there should be presumptively open hearings, but his argument is on what standards should be used. Do you have any input on what standards you think there should be as far as the abuse of discretion? Should it be a heightened review or standard abuse of discretion review, and what standards do we look at?
I think it should be a heightened sense in the sense that we have a First Amendment right at stake. Now, Mr. Hallam said we don't have a First Amendment right at stake until the United States Supreme Court says we do. I think all indications are we don't need to wait for that pronouncement. We do have a presumption of an open courtroom, and I think it's based in the First Amendment. And once we have that, I think the court simply cannot say, this is the way I would rather do it. And that essentially is what happened here. I think I'm not necessarily going to say it has to reach the level of strict scrutiny, even though some courts require that there has to be a substantial probability that a trade secret will be divulged or a criminal won't get a fair trial.
Which case are you relying on for the proposition that the presumption in a civil case like this arises from the First Amendment?
There's a whole litany of cases that presume. Well, I mean, even the cases upon which Judge Delaney relied, discipline of Johnson. Balanced. Pointing to the litany of common law and constitutional rights and interests and access.
That's common law. I'm looking for a First Amendment case. Is it in your brief?
Yes, I think I believe that the circuit court cases that are cited, application Dow Jones, KNBC TV versus Superior Court, which is a California Supreme Court case, said indeed. Let me quote that. That's a good one. It's footnote 30 of my reply brief. Indeed, every lower court opinion of which we are aware that has addressed the issue of First Amendment access to civil trials and proceedings has reached the conclusion that the constitutional right of access applies to civil as well as to criminal trials, and then cites Publicker Industries versus Cohen, Westmoreland versus CBS. Iowa Freedom of Information.
Is there any language in the South Dakota Constitution equivalent provision to the First Amendment that might prompt us to interpret our Constitution to say that there is such a presumption? Other than that, we've already talked about the open courts, but any other provision that's equivalent to our First Amendment?
Well, I think our free press freedom, which is the equivalent, is that Article 6? I can't remember which article it is, but I think it's the analogy. And I understand the First Amendment does not say open courtrooms. It doesn't talk about courtrooms. But I think in a democratic society, we have to have some philosophical ground rules. And I think one of them is that our three branches of government are typically going to be open unless we have a compelling reason to close them. And we have had compelling reasons to close courtrooms and to impose orders of restraint. National security, we protect juveniles. I agree we should protect trade secrets. But nowhere in the record that I was given do I see that there's a trade secret at risk. All the judge really was concerned about was the privacy of these people. And quite honestly, if they want to come into the American court system and litigate family business, so be it. You know, that is one of the risks they take, that they're going to have to expose stuff that they wouldn't necessarily have to expose to their neighbor if they didn't want to. On the other hand, if they want to talk to their neighbor, they should be able to. And the judge shouldn't presume that he should tell them otherwise. I don't think that he had good cause in this case, and I think whether the standard is reasonable likelihood of prejudice or substantial probability of prejudice, which is the strict scrutiny standard, in either case, the test requires a compelling interest on the other side of the presumption of openness. We start with that, and in this case, Judge Delaney, as the record indicates, did not start with a presumption of openness. He declined to find a presumption of openness in the court system. He said, that's not what I'm getting from this language. I am getting that the public doesn't have a right to know anything in the court that they couldn't know outside of the court. And I completely disagree with that. That is completely wrong in my estimation, and that's really why we're here.
If we agree with you on that, is there any utility in sending this back for him to decide under the proper standard
whether
the materials are trade secrets?
I'd love to have, I know that puts a heck of a burden on this court to create a standard, but I think basically what we're looking for here is a theoretical, yes, you were right, and maybe in the actuality of the future, another court will say, I'm going to be careful. I'm not going to simply impose my view of newsworthiness here, or I'm not going to assume we're going to divulge stuff that won't be divulged.
Thank you, Mr. Addison. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.